It's the California Wine Country Podcast with Steve Jackson and Dan Berger. We taste, we laugh, we learn.
This is Pete Fopiano sitting in for Steve Jackson. And as I look across the table, I see a myriad of bottles of wine. So this must be California Wine Country with Dan Berger. And today, Dan's guest is Jed Steele of Steele Wines. And Rusty, who is he's the important man in this operation because he is opening the bottles of wine. And without him, this would be a very, you know, kind of a short segment when we're critiquing this.
We only have six bottles, Pete.
And we've got until 6 o'clock. So if we apply ourselves diligently, we can make it through every single one of them.
Absolutely correct.
So, okay. Dan, I'm going to turn it over to you and let you begin the show.
This is the most fun hour of the year for me because Jed's been around forever. Well, I shouldn't say forever, but Jed's been making wine since I remember. He made a 1975 ice wine. Ice wine in California when he was in the Anderson Valley.
That's right. That's a long time ago.
That's interesting. I tried ice wine for the very first time. It was in Enniskillen.
Right.
About 15 years ago up in Vancouver. And I thought, this is the most unusual and delightful taste experience I've had in quite some time. It was really intriguing. And, you know, they told us all about how it was made. But I didn't realize you made ice wine here in California.
He was the first one to ever make an ice wine in the United States, as far as I know.
Really?
Right. Yeah, we actually made it 2 years. We made the year Dan mentioned, and then we made it in 1980. But we just had we haven't had those kind of weather conditions since. It got down to mid-November. It got down to 18 degrees, you know, which we haven't, you know, climate change or whatever you want to say. So, yeah, it was a blast.
That was a Kolenbord, as I recall.
Right. That was the block that was, you know, we had to set up the logistics because, you know, we were out there picking at 5 o'clock in the morning because we wanted to make sure the temperature didn't rise. And the Kolenbord was right next to the winery. So logistically, we said, heck, we'll go with this. But yeah, I still got a couple bottles of it.
I'm sure with that acid, I'm sure it held up.
Oh, yeah. It had a great label. Bill Zaka, who was the founder of the Mendocino Art Center, did the label for us. It was a great label.
So you got quite an array of things here. And what I like about Steele Wines has been about for the last several years is you really go to the end of the earth almost to make a lot of these wines because you're going to the places where these grapes do best. And logistically, it's a little bit more difficult. But these are just delightful wines. Your Pinot Blanc, we're going to start with that, I assume. So tell us a little bit about that Pinot Blanc.
It comes from a great vineyard down in Santa Barbara County in Santa Maria Valley. It's the Bien Nacido Vineyard, which is renowned for Chardonnay and Pinot Noir, but they have a small acreage of Pinot Blanc as well. So we work with them. They also have a custom crush facility, so we get the grapes picked, taken to their custom crush facility about 20 minutes away, and they juice it. And chill the juice to 35 degrees and then ship it up in a stainless steel tanker. And we go ahead and ferment it and age it. It's, I'm a fan of barrel fermentation for wines like Chardonnay and Pinot Blanc. So we do barrel ferment it, but we want to get the effect of barrel fermentation, but not necessarily the effect of oak. So they're all older barrels, all older French and Hungarian barrels. And again, I'm an advocate of malolactic, and the wine goes through malolactic and then is usually bottled in the summer sometime.
Yeah, Pinot Blanc is really underrated. I think a lot of people who love Pinot Blanc use it as an alternative to Chardonnays that are typically not aged in brand new barrels. Because if you age Chardonnay in a barrel, sometimes you can get that oak component to really stand on top of the fruit. Pinot Blanc is slightly different, and to me it's more interesting grape in one respect because there's a citrusy note that if you don't need the oak, you can expose that citrus and it becomes a more interesting wine, I think. But this was fermented in stainless steel, so you didn't have the barrel contact during the fermentation process.
Well, we start the fermentation in stainless, and then when the because we want the lees contact, you know, in the barrel. So once the fermentation starts to slow down, we rack into barrels to finish fermentation and go through malolactic.
The other thing that you've been able to do is to go for other varieties from other areas, but you're all seemingly specializing now more and more in Lake County. And I especially love the Cabernet Francs that you've
right.
made. And in particular, you've got more than one of them, and they're all the fabulous thing about this is that it's a variety that really does take on its own unique characteristic, and it's not like Cabernet Sauvignon.
No.
Well, let's go on to this Pinot Blanc, back to it. Oh, that's really pretty. There's a little bit of tropical note in here.
You get that from the Santa Barbara fruit.
Wow, that's really fascinating. And the little, I notice your notes show honeydew melon character. I definitely agree with that. And the oak is really held way back on this wine.
Yes.
Great acidity. Only 13.5 alcohol. That's really nice. And is this how many cases do you make of this every year?
Oh, between 500 and 1,000.
It's got to have broad distribution then.
Yes. Yeah, we're distributed nationally. I think I don't think we're in West Virginia, but other than that, it's in broad distribution.
It's a fun wine to. Did you taste it, Pete?
I did. I just took a sip of it. It's very, very, very good. Very nice. What would you recommend, for example, if you were having folks over to dinner and you wanted to serve something with this wine? What dish do you think would go best with it?
Well, I personally think scallops would be the call for me because I love the delicacy of scallops. And this wine is not a very powerful wine. It's just delicate. It's got beautiful fruit.
Yeah, I think scallops are a good call.
So you think something basically a little more delicate so it wouldn't overpower the wine because the wine is fairly delicate. It's not something you'd want to serve a red meat, which would really just seem to me to overpower the entire wine.
No, I think it crab would be good.
Oh, yeah, crab it would be. If you can get something really fragrant, a lot of crab these days seems to be served with a lot of cream sauces. I'm bored with that. Don't give me that. But something that's got a little bit more of a lighter touch on with
the crab. I mean, I was thinking crab cakes.
There you go. That's good.
Or maybe just a simple cracked crab with butter or so, whatever. Just boil it down to the essentials, so to speak.
You know? And there's a little bit. I noticed your notes say something about green apple, and I get that, but I think the lemon characteristic is coming out a little bit more. Very pretty wine. Is this available in, I assume, Bottle Barns got this?
I really don't know, Dan.
I'm sure he's. Barry is not in today.
No, we don't have him in today, so we can't speak for Bottle Barn. Although they have such a large selection, I would imagine that they probably do. But
I hope so.
I would encourage listeners to go and look for themselves.
Well, absolutely. The market is sort of fractured over the last, 3 or 4 years. The marketplace has changed a lot. Millennials really are interested in a diverse selection. They want things that are not common. Cabernet still sells, Chardonnay still sells, but not with the same fervor as we once saw. Now we're beginning to see people reaching out for other wines, and Pinot Blanc is like the perfect alternative because it does have that unusual, I mean, the name itself is not as common as you would think, and it's been around. It's a European variety. It's been around for a long, long time. But this is really a great example of that, and Bien Nacido has been planted for a long, long time. So this is a really stable older vines selection, I would imagine. You know, the fun thing about Jed's been doing. How many years is this for you? How many years have you been a winemaker?
Well, my first vintage as a head winemaker was 1974. I worked in wineries, in the cellar prior to that.
That's a fair bit.
You're 45.
Not getting tired of this, are you?
A little bit.
that makes you an elder statesman. In that case,
yes, definitely an elder. Definitely, yeah. Yeah, I've been fortunate to work. I used to do a lot of consulting. I consulted for that whole, for I think, was it 15 years for the Chateau Saint Michel group, primarily with a property in Walla Walla, North Star Merlot property. And then I worked with the Parkers down in Santa Barbara for many years, Fess Parker Winery. So, yeah, all over the map.
So what this portends is that if you're looking for forward-thinking, modern-style winemaking with mature vineyards and some grapes that are not particularly well-known. I know you do a I think you have about several, three or four varieties that are simply not made in, by many other wineries.
Yeah, we do some, again, because of my long association with Washington State, I was exposed up there to Blaufränkisch. And so we make a Blue Franc, we call it, Blaufränkisch. And in the past, we've also, up in Washington, they had some Aligoté. So we make, on occasion, make Aligoté as well, which are definitely pretty eclectic.
I would say that the Aligoté would be one of those that you would ask somebody what it is, and they'd say, it's an Italian lawyer.
That would have been my guess, but then again, I'm not. California Wine Country, of course, featuring Dan Berger with Jed Steele of Steele Wines. And Jed has just poured us a 2016 Pinot Noir. And Dan was, you know, making some comments about what he felt about the wine. So, Dan, I'm going to turn it over to you to finish it off there.
Well, I kind of like this, slightly Burgundian characteristic. What's fascinating about Pinot Noir is that it does reflect its soil and its region as well as any red wine you can think. And I think in this exact example, you're dealing with something that when this vineyard was first planted to Pinot Noir, I didn't think that there was very much excitement to it. But as years have gone by, how old is this vineyard now?
Planted in 1998.
So it's finally gotten a little bit of age on it, but these grapes have finally settled down. I like the 15 and the 14, but this 16 is just wonderful because it's got real, honest to goodness, you called it Bing cherries, but I'm also getting a little bit of a light blackberry kind of a note to it. It's not typical to find blackberries in Pinot, but in this case, there's such deep fruit to it. And then what's really, I think, made this wine is the fact that there's no particular noticeable oak here. This is all fruit, and this is really the kind of fruit that you want to have on the dinner table because it's got so much vibrancy. Another benefit is 13.8 alcohol, not 15.
No, those days are over.
Well, it's just,
except for Zinfandel sometimes.
Well, there are a couple of those out there. But I think some of the Pinot Noir producers don't mind having 15% because it gives them what they call extraction. I think Pinot Noir doesn't need extraction. Essentially, this is white wine with color.
Yeah, no, a lot of the winemaking techniques are almost white wine techniques.
Boy, the flavors really just go on and on and on.
San Giacomo's are great. Great grape growers. They've been in the Sonoma Valley for ever, it seems like. Angelo San Giacomo was the patriarch for years, and now his two sons and son-in-law run it. They were raised in the vineyard. They just a wonderful family, wonderful grape growers.
Is this a vineyard? Now, this does say San Giacomo, and then it says Carneros, is it, or Green Acres.
Green Acres. It's a specific block.
Is there something specific about this block that characteristically gives you something slightly different?
Well, it's a Dijon clone, it was planted when they were Dijon 115. It's not a high yielding, 3 tons an acre maybe, vineyard. So I had actually tasted wines other wineries had made from this vineyard and was coveting it. And a few years ago, the San Giacomo's, I had expressed that interest to them. They had a little bit of fruit. So we only get, 5-6 tons of this. We get a lot of San Giacomo Pinot, which goes into our Carneros bottling. But as far as the Green Acres, it's a small tonnage, small production.
Well, terrific balance. And the fact that the French oak influence here is so subtle leads me to believe that this is going to be a really wonderful wine about 5 more years, 6 more years. Do you ever think about what it's like to put these wines out on the market so soon? I mean, everybody's doing it. Everybody's putting them out early.
Yeah. You know, it's just the way of the wine world. We were in Florence a few years ago, so it was like, you know, 2015. And a lot of the restaurants had 2007s, 2009s, 2011. But over here, you know, it's sort of part of the American purchasing psyche that newer is better. You know, the new car routine, you know, the new iPhone. And it's, I think, penetrated the psyche to where people carry it over into wine, unfortunately. I mean, we'll have a beautiful, say, 2014 Carneros Pinot, which is just in beautiful shape. But we're currently selling 2016, and a distributor will call up and say, well, this is aged inventory, you know, because that's what their computer told them. And it has no connection with reality of what's in the bottle. It's at, you know, I mean, I'd much rather drink the 2014 than the 2016. But it's, like I said, it's penetrated the American buying psyche, I think.
It kind of flies in the face of what we always thought was like the traditional attitude toward wine, is that, you know, in some cases you age a wine and it develops more character, whatever, and it becomes better with age. You know, not indefinitely, obviously, but it has a peak time. And I guess everybody's just too impatient. They don't want to wait and you know, buy this wine and hold it for 3 or 4 years. Interestingly, before we took the break, I made a comment about wines and aging and how long you should hold them or so. And as if by magic, we now have sitting in front of us a 1997 Syrah. So, Dan, I'd be really interested to hear your comments about this wine.
Well, yeah, Steve likes to call me the lay-it-down king, and I would definitely lay this one down, and obviously it was properly. But what's amazing about a wine like this is that when this came out on the market, probably very few people in California would have imagined a Syrah would go 22 years. In this case, it's still getting better. I mean, we've been swirling it here for about 10 minutes, and it is just fabulous wine. Still got that leathery component, but it's a fresh new leather kind of thing. So it's not in any way lost any of its fruit. The fruit is still very vibrant. And what I like about it is that the acid is still holding it together, but the tannins have now subsided a little bit from what it was at the beginning. And, boy, this is really a delightful wine. Hey, Rusty, you're the guy who has to talk about these things. Tell us about what your thoughts are on this wine.
Well, I think you're right, and you made a good comment about 22 years ago. I don't even think anybody knew what Syrah was. I mean, it was just starting to gain in popularity, and yet here is Jared already looking around for alternatives. And I mean, I sometimes call Jed the king of SKUs because he makes so many wines. But I guarantee you, there weren't a lot of people making Syrah 22 years ago.
And very few people buying it and putting it in the cellar.
That's right.
This is a delight. It's so fresh. It's so vibrant. And yet it still carries the character of Syrah. It does have that rustic sort of brutish character to it.
But it's not so big that you just, it's overpoweringly meaty or bloody.
Right.
And the tannins just have resolved themselves so nicely. It's a great wine.
Yeah. It's 97, as I was telling Dan during the break, was one of those, you know, when you ask wine, I get asked, you know, what's the best vintage you ever had? I've had almost 50 vintages working in the cellar and as a winemaker. And 1997 is, to me, was the best vintage I've ever encountered. Everything turned out just great, and added to that as a bonus, it was a big harvest. And normally people equate low yields with high quality, but every once in a while you get that perfect storm of weather and you get quantity and quality, which was reflected in this wine. And, you know, a lot of times with wines this old, they'll fade in the glass after a few minutes, you know. This wine's just getting stronger.
Yeah. It's improving, and I think the aeration is helpful in one respect, too, because as you when you first pull the cork and you pour it, you smell that fruit, and the complexity is not quite up to where you want it. But as it sits here for about 20 minutes, suddenly you realize, hey, this is really complex also, and the fruit is not going away. It's still standing right there.
Well, and it comes from a vineyard owned by a great grape grower, Steve Hill. Steve originally got into the business in the early 80s and planted and managed the Durrell Vineyard, which is a tremendously high-quality vineyard down in Sonoma Valley, right near the Carneros Appalachian line. And Steve's president in past years of the Sonoma County Grape Growers. He's knowledgeable, great guy to work with. And before Ed Durrell passed away, he made a sweetheart deal to Steve and carved a little bit of the Durrell vineyard out and sold it to him. It's a hillside, and that's where this so it's a cool climate Syrah, but has aged dramatically.
Sensational glass of wine, and the sad news for everybody, it's not available. Sorry to say, when 22 years go by, don't ask the winery if they got any. It's too late.
We actually have a library, and we've still got probably a case or two in the library.
Well, if you were born in 1997, you have to go visit Steele and just plead. He's probably going to say no anyway. That's right. That's
well, if you're born in 1997, you're just barely legally able to drink wine.
That's true.
So, you know.
What's next?
Okay, what's the next? I still see a number of bottles that are laying there.
Well, so we've got two wines. I don't know if you want to. How much time do we have left?
We got about 8 minutes until the next break, and then a couple minutes after that before wind up the show.
Yeah, we can pour the Malbec then.
Malbec. Okay.
Malbec is an interesting grape variety. It's often has a little bit of a blue character, almost a blueberry component. We'll see how that is.
Okay. Now, I haven't seen too much Malbec around. I mean, is that just me, or is this not a widely distributed or widely produced type of wine?
Malbec is getting more interesting as we get better handle on how it should grow. The Argentine Malbec has been hugely successful in the marketplace because it's inexpensive. But what I find on the Argentine Malbecs is they tend to be somewhat one-dimensional. They're all fruit, and they're not very complex. And in this example, this is from Lake County, and this has got a lot more complexity than you'll find in most of the Argentine Malbecs. And if you were to find one that had this much character, you'd pay quite a bit more for it. This is only $17, and boy, this is just a delightful wine. That little blue note in it, blueberry note, is really attractive. But there's also a gray handling. Did you have to do much fining to get the tannins down on this?
We used some gelatin, but not a normal dose, not an extra heavy dose.
I mean, structurally, it kind of reminds me a little teeny bit of Pinot Noir because it does have that silky entry. It does have a little bit more tannin than Pinot, but the flavors are fabulous.
Well, it comes from an outstanding vineyard. We're, as you said, Rusty mentioned Lake County. Our winery is located in Lake County, and one of the top, if not the top vineyard there is owned by Andy Beckstoffer, who's also the largest owner of Cabernet in Napa Valley. He's primarily Cabernet is in the vineyard. However, he has a small acreage of Malbec. He's probably got 800 acres of Cabernet, maybe 10 acres of Malbec, and that's what this wine is based on. But and he's again the penultimate professional grape grower. The grapes are just pristine, and it's just a real pleasure to work with him and his fruit.
When I was in Argentina about 4 years ago, we tasted, I think it was 32 or 33 wines altogether, and my notes were so similar from one wine to the next. It was almost as if I was tasting the same thing over and over again. What I like about California Malbec is that Malbec tends to have a kind of a vibrancy to it that you never see in other countries. And now they are using largely American oak aging, and I think sometimes their aging regime is a little bit too much heavily influenced by the American oak. So this is really a very, very lovely wine, and it says that you're using French, American, and Hungarian, which I think is really helpful to give it that level of complexity.
Interesting.
What do you think about it, Pete?
I think it's to me it's very full bodied. But when you know when you use the word stronger, but it's not strong in a bad sense. I mean, it's strong in a rich, flavorful sense. It's not something where you'd notice some pungent notes or some notes of tannin. I mean, it seems as though it's strong, but in a good way. I mean, I realize I'm using layman's terms because I'm a layman, but on the other hand, it's very pleasant, and with that character that you mentioned that it had.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of Malbec from Washington State. I think they do a wonderful job with Malbec in Washington, but up until 2 years ago, their wines were too tannic, and we talked and talked to the winemakers, and some of them finally said after admitting that I said I wouldn't put it in print. Until you guys solve it, well, they solved it. And we're now starting to see a lot of Malbec coming out of California that's doing the same thing, dealing with the tannins and not allowing the tannins to be interfering with your enjoyment of the aftertaste.
Yeah, and this to me, again, this does not seem that that's the case. They are definitely not interfering with the taste and the aroma of the wine. So
that's really gorgeous wine. $17, that's a bargain.
Yeah.
I mean, if you could get a wine this good for $17, I'm not sure why an import would satisfy your desires for the same price, essentially. I think this is better wine.
Well, it goes to show that you don't, a high cost does not necessarily mean a higher quality. I mean, there's quite frankly, I've tasted some wines that cost a fair amount. And I found them inferior to other wines that cost $20 or less per bottle. And again, that's just my taste buds, but I'm not alone, I believe, in that way of thinking.
No, there's no question that that's correct. And I think the problem we always have with this is that there are styles that come and go. But when it's a new wine, for the first time I ever saw Carmenere from Chile, they were making it the wrong way. Now that they've got their act together, Chilean Carmenere is fascinating. Interesting one.
This is Pete Fopiano sitting in for Steve Jackson, and this is California Wine Country with Dan Berger and Jed Steele and Rusty of Steele Wines. And during the break, they have just poured what I think is an absolutely delightful 97 dessert wine. For those of you who fancy dessert wines, this is incredible. I would recommend this. This is one of my favorites. Dan, why don't you take a moment and tell us a little bit about your perceptions of this?
Sort of takes my breath away. It's the aroma on this wine reminds me of dried peaches and apricots. But there's also a freshness to it, too. It's not just the dry fruit. The freshness comes from almost a pineapple-y kind of a note, but it's gone past that because of the aging process. We're talking about a white wine that's like 22 years old. What's really fascinating is that there's botrytis in here, which gives you that honeyed component, but at the same time, you've got that almost ice wine level of acid. It's a pretty astounding wine. Did you know how this was aging when you made it?
Well, I knew it was probably, it has all the components, relatively high alcohol, extremely high sugar, high acid. I knew it would age. I didn't know it was going to age this well. But I've drunk it periodically over the years, so I've been following its evolution.
Well, this is the kind of wine that the millennials would love to have a shot at because the younger buyers today are very excited about newness and different styles of wine. This is definitely a style you won't see in very many projects. But we're also beginning to see an interest in rosé. We're beginning to see an interest in unusual grape varieties like Barbera. We saw some Barbera Rosé on the shelf the other day, and it's not bad at all. It's interesting. But I think also we're beginning to see obscure grape varieties like Negrette name those grape varieties that you never heard of before. There are a handful of them that I've been seeing on the shelf, and I'm saying, why is this? Well, I think there's a lot of people out there were trying to make wines that nobody had ever heard of before because previously they didn't sell. And now maybe you can pick up some Fiano and put it in a bottle, and maybe you can make somebody interested in Fiano again or something like that. Arnais stuff, you know, Arnais has been commonly made in Italy, but we're starting to see even California Arnais. Tasted a Viña today that's really beautiful. So a lot of the people who are making wine are realizing that the latest trend for the millennial crowd is something that's unusual and that has a unique characteristic. And that's important.
Interesting. All I know is that it's excellent. 97, so it's probably not available to the general public, unfortunately.
No, these are both the 97 Syrah, 97 late harvest, early harvest Chardonnay are library wines. Yeah.
Well, I guess our listeners will just have to enjoy them vicariously through us because they are excellent, and we're almost out of time. But Dan, I wanted to. Well, first of all, you know, Jed Steele and Rusty, thank you for coming in and sharing your samples with us. Dan, take a minute or so, and as we talked about before, what do you see as some of the emerging trends in the wine world?
Well, I see lighter styles. I think previously where Chardonnay was aged in new oak and had maybe a little trace of sugar, now we're beginning to see winemakers rethink how these wines are being made, and we're beginning to see more typical examples, not, I would say, European-styled examples. So we're starting to see Sauvignon Blanc that's a little bit more delicate, Chardonnay that doesn't have as much oak or alcohol. We're starting to see some Cabernets that actually smell and taste like Cabernet, which I would say over the last decade has been a little bit questionable. Also, I think the consumer is more likely to want to pick something up that somebody advertises to them as. They're not worried about that number anymore. They're not worried about that 96 or 97 points. They're looking more for, this is distinctive. This is different. And when they hear that, they're getting excited.
So not so much what, you know, going by numbers or reviews or so forth. They want to see something new and different and exciting and essentially come to their own conclusions as to what they really like.
Exactly.
Which is, you know, to me, that's the way I've always approached wine. But then again, you are the expert, and as such, I want to thank you for coming in on this episode of California Wine Country. Jed Steele, Rusty, thank you for sharing your wine samplings with us and for coming in today.